Right. This afternoon, we're starting off with a topic I mentioned earlier, and that was an update on proposed standards and concept releases. There's the proposed standards on risk assessment that I mentioned a number of times, and two concept releases, one on the use of confirmations and one of signing the audit report. And we'd like to give you an update. The comment periods are closed, but we'd like to give you an update on the comments we have received and then open it up for any commentary that you might have. The first item we're going to discuss is the proposed standard on risk assessment, and to my left, Keith Wilson will lead that discussion.
Thank you, Marty. Approximately a year ago at this time, the board issued for comment, as Marty mentioned earlier, a suite of seven proposed auditing standards and related conforming amendments regarding the auditor's responsibilities for assessing and responding to risk in an audit. The comment period closed in February, and we received 33 comment letters. The demographics, as you see on the slide, 18 or roughly 54% of those came from auditing firms and associations of accountants. The next group of commenters were academics and groups of academics, about 12%, and then there was roughly a mixture among issuers, business groups, internal auditors, an investor representative, and some other standard setters and individuals. Now, what I want to try and do for these next couple of slides is talk about just some of the general themes that came through in the comment letter process. And to do that and help set the stage for that, I'd like to back up and give you just a few minutes of background. When this proposal was issued, the board outlined and identified a list of objectives that they wanted to try and accomplish through this project. The first one of those was to update the board's standards relating to risk assessment to, in light of the changes and the audit methodologies that are risk-based that have been implemented and are prevalent in practice. The second one is to further the integration of the standards relating to risk assessment with the standard for the audit of internal control over financial reporting, AS number 5. And the third was to try to incorporate into these standards the general principles for identifying, assessing, and responding to the risk of material misstatement due to fraud that have existed in the board's interim standard on fraud, but to make the fraud responsibilities a more central part of the risk assessment process. And as part of the development process for these standards, the board did look carefully at the related risk assessment standards of the International Auditing and Assurance Standards Board, particularly looking at the objectives and the requirements of those standards and trying to determine whether they were appropriate for audits of issuers, which is our area of responsibility. So, as you can see now from this slide, we received a lot of comments in each of those areas. First of all, there was general support. Almost everyone who commented in a comprehensive way, at least, supported the idea of updating these standards to speak more directly to the risk-based audit. There was also pretty broad support for enhancing the integration of these risk assessment standards with the standard for internal control over financial reporting. And in fact, we received a number of comments that would seek to improve that integration. For example, trying to move more of the risk assessment requirements into these standards out of auditing standard number 5. When it comes to the fraud-related aspects, the views were a bit mixed. We had 15 people specifically comment on the topic of integrating these standards more closely with fraud, and 8 of the 15 were supportive of the board's approach. There were 4 who were not as supportive of the board's approach or expressed some concerns about it, and then the remaining 3 were somewhat neutral or ambivalent about it. An example of that would be, yes, we could see doing that, but our methodology already integrates the consideration of fraud into our core methodology, so we don't think it would have any effect on practice one way or the other. So more of a neutral stance with respect to that. Then in terms of perhaps more technical or specific comments, we received a number of comments related to the extent and nature of the requirements in the standards. Comments such as there were a comparison of these standards to the IAASB standards or the ASB standards, and they may observe that our proposal had more requirements than a comparable IAASB standard. There were also cases where they commented on the specific language of a requirement, for example, saying that we really needed to explicitly build into the language of a requirement the qualify it based on the auditor's use of professional judgment. There were a host of other comments related to what I'll call the use of terms to describe the auditor's responsibilities. And here we're actually talking about verbs. So where we may have a requirement for the auditor to evaluate or assess a matter, we receive some comments that to use a different choice of words, such as the auditor should consider a given matter. So, and usually those were, again, in comparison to either the board's interim standard or the related standards of the IAASB or ASB. We received a number of comments about the organization and style of these standards. These proposed standards had a slightly different format from some of the previously issued standards of the board. For example, there was a specific section that outlined the objective of each of these proposed standards. And the commenters were supportive of having an objective in each standard, certainly. They did indicate some, not necessarily reservations about the format we used, but basically came down to you need to develop a standard template for your standards, a standard style, and just implement that and follow it from now on. So we received a fair number of comments related to that. And then finally, there were a series of comments about the effective date of the standards. We hadn't specifically mentioned or proposed an effective date for the standards, but we received a number of comments. A lot of them were related to guidelines on how the board should determine its effective date for the standards, along the lines of please allow us enough time to change our methodologies and to be able to have enough time to train the staff and those kinds of things. And an important point that was also made by a number of those commenters was that the board should propose a specific effective date and seek comment on that prior to actually adopting the standards. So those are some of the most common comments that we received on the standards. Be interested in any reactions. We'll open this up for discussion, and whether you have comments about these, the standards themselves, maybe views that support some of the comments we received, or other views. Does anyone have a reaction to the idea of the approach for incorporating the general responsibilities for fraud into these standards? Any comments one way or the other on that topic?
Keith, I was interested in that point, of course, and I was wondering if others might be, as you said, there were kind of mixed views on whether or not to embed fraud throughout the planning and throughout the risk assessment process and throughout the audit, but there were some who view that as not a good idea, not neutral, but some were negative on that. Could you expand more on ones who were negative on that?
I guess the way I would characterize the most of those concerns were around the lines of they tended to prefer having a separate standard that was focused specifically on fraud. They thought it was helpful to have all of the auditor's responsibilities related to fraud summarized in one place, and preferred that to the approach of incorporating the key aspects into the core standards for risk assessment.
Keith, if I might ask, it's been some time since I've read these, and so when you ask for, do we have any comments, I wasn't really expecting it. What's the timetable now? Could we give you any comments by email on the specific standards, or what's doable here? Because I feel like I'm maybe not quite as prepared as I could have been.
Well, actually, I think the comment period is closed, and we're in the process now of revising the proposed standards and putting them before the board. I think I indicated earlier that our target was to issue proposed standards in reproposed these standards in December is our target. We wanted to present today, generally in keeping with the theme of updating the SAG in terms of developments, what was the nature of the comments we received. And as long as we were doing that, we just thought we would take the opportunity today, if anybody wanted to react to the comments we received or had something else to say, to do that. But other than that, I'd say that essentially the comment period is closed. So thank you.
Damon Silvers?
I mean, I spoke earlier today about the fraud standard, which I guess some of the commenters felt was a better place to address these issues than in the sort of in risk assessment and sort of throughout the standard, the bodies of auditing standards. I mean, I think the board ought to be wary of a catch-22 here, right? I mean, there's been plenty of instances in Washington of people who don't want to do anything always pointing you somewhere else. Like wherever you are, wherever you're actually acting, they well, oh, no, that's not the right place to act. Go over here. When you get over there, then they oh, no, that's not the right place to act. Come back here. Right. The board should be wary of that kind of thing. My own view is that I think you need to do both. I think that there needs to be a clear, overarching set of obligations on auditors in relation to fraud. And then I think there needs to be an understanding, and then those that basic framework needs to be embedded, right, in areas such as risk assessment, where it's clearly, I think, part of what the investing public thinks is happening here, is that auditors are keeping an eye out for circumstances that lend them, that would appear to increase the probability that fraud may be occurring. I also see fraud as a continuum, as one end of a continuum of potential problems with a financial statement, and that in setting standards for risk assessment, I'm not sure how I think you have to give guidance and more than guidance for looking for mistakes. Looking for conduct, which I think is somewhere, I'm not sure the term of art, but there is something between a mistake and fraud, right? I think it's a little bit more intentional than a mistake. And then, but for the insistence of an auditor that the principles of financial accounting have to be complied with, would go forward, but it's not something forgetting how to add. I don't see how you give the guide. I don't see how you set a set of standards around risk assessment, taking into account that range of human behavior, and not embody in it some attitude toward assessing the risk of fraud. And so, like I said, I think both is the right answer.
Okay. Thank you. Just before we move on to Gary, let me just mention that we, as a point of clarification, we are intending that there continue to be a separate standard related to fraud. But we do feel like there's some important principles that need to be captured in there, too. So
I was suggesting that the overall fraud standard needs to be strengthened, right, at the same time as you're undertaking this exercise.
Right.
So I'm sort of the opposite of the person who says do nothing, you know, I do everything.
All right, very good. Gary Cabaret?
Yeah, thanks. Actually, I think Damon said a lot of what I was going to say. Is I think, Marty, in your opening comments, you had said these standards, these seven things, they're going to become foundational audit standards as opposed to tactical. And if they're foundational, I think the possible existence of fraud or the auditor's inspection for it is one of the central things auditors do work on. And I think it should be in there. I think, again, maybe you want a separate fraud standard of how to deploy, you know, audit procedures, but I would think in the risk standards you'd want to come up with an answer to questions: is fraud a primary or secondary audit, you know, objective? And do you automatically assume fraud, or is it only when evidence of possible fraud emerges? And are you looking for positive or negative evidence? I think that should be in the risk standard. And again, maybe in different standards, maybe you've got, you know, different, you know, goals for them. Then in a separate fraud standard, okay, if I have to assume fraud exists as a primary audit objective, how do I actually go about doing that? What is the standards of detailed audit performance? But I think if these are truly foundational standards, these seven, I don't know how fraud can't be inside of it.
Thank you. Ben Coleman?
Yeah, Damon, I know you're a lawyer and not an auditor, and I'm an auditor, and I do this for a living. Do you mind, I just try to understand, make sure I fully understand what you're saying, and can you just, perhaps for me, if you start at a forensic audit, right, and then you work your way along the continuum, the vision you're articulating that either came from Treasury or where you want to go, I'm just trying to understand where you want to go, where do you put yourself along that continuum so I understand when... You know, because when you're saying both a separate standard and embedding it on the standards, and we're going to talk about this afternoon because it's certainly in some of the other materials that we got, I'm just trying to understand the vision of what you're articulating. Could you do that along the continuum?
I'm like Gargalin in that I don't actually have the text of the fraud standard in front of me, but I will give you but I think it's a very fair question. Because I think we definitely should not be expecting that every audit is a forensic audit. I think there's a risk of that there's a risk of that in this way of thinking.
Right, because that's what I hear when you're articulating it. That's what I kind of hear you saying.
Yeah,
that's why I'm looking for the clarification.
Right, and that's absolutely not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is I think that we need to move the dial a bit. On the overall audit standard, so that there is an overall obligation on the auditor to be. I'm sorry, the IT guys tell me that's wrong with my mic. That we need to move the overall dial on the audit standard to create. Oh, it's my BlackBerry. Put it in my pocket. See, I just got one. I just gave in and got one of these things, and I don't know,
how they're evil.
That's what Sam and I have been discussing, the various pernicious qualities of BlackBerries, both recognizing that neither of us would, you know, part with it any more than we'd part with our right arms. I think this is why the sort of the risk assessment area is one where it's particularly good, would be a particularly good idea to have an integrated approach that then embodied this approach elsewhere. So I think that they need to move the dial a little bit in terms of auditors having some obligation some greater obligation than is currently embodied in the current fraud standard, to act in contexts where there's essentially a reasonable suspicion. And I think you then need to embody that in areas such as this, that approach in areas such as this. I don't think that we can create I mean, this was a subject of some extensive discussion in the Treasury Committee. Some people, and I think Lynn may feel that my basic approach is not tough enough, and unfortunately he's not here at the moment, maybe he'll chime in later. Some people felt that we ought to be moving very much toward a kind of absolute liability standard. Right? You don't find fraud, it's the auditor's fault. That is not my view. I think that there are, but it's also not my view that fraud is something unrelated to the audit, and looking for fraud is something unrelated to the audit. That doesn't parse with what I think the public's expectation is of the auditing profession.
Greg Jonas?
I perceive a disconnect in something, and it's probably just me, so a little education would help me. But my understanding is that we've proposed substantive, foundational thinking with these seven standards, that it was well thought out, that the comment letters have come back. I'm interpreting your comments to be generally supportive, and yet you plan to repropose as a next step, suggesting to me that you see certain major areas that are broken to the point that you have new thinking that you want to put in place and expose that for public comment. Could you elaborate for me on what you think about your initial proposal that is in a major way broken that would cause you to want to repropose? Because I'm not hearing that in our comments, and that's the disconnect that I perceive.
I'll start on that, and Keith can follow on. I think because of the fact that these are so important in terms of being foundational standards, we want to make sure that we have it absolutely right. So I think it's not so much that what we proposed, we got back comments that indicated there were significant deficiencies in it. We did get back good comments, and in some places we've made changes in response to those comments. In some places we decided not to make changes. But because they, as I said, we think they're important enough and so important to the foundation of the entire audit, the risk assessment process, planning the audit, considering the impacts of materiality and judgments, that we want to put it out one more time, let everybody see how we've amended the proposals, and then just get comments back and then go final.
So Marty, help me out with a little percentage. If you know, 0% would be a re-exposure of exactly what you had before, and 100% would be I'm going to change everything I proposed before, where are you on that continuum, would you guess, roughly? A 10% course correction?
That's a very interesting question, and I don't know that I've really thought of it in terms of a specific percentage. Let me try and say that some of the things that we're contemplating now and that we're looking at doing with these standards tend to be more in the areas of refinements, not major structural changes, if that helps in terms of the way we're looking at the standards.
That's an 11% comment.
Okay. You're much more comfortable with percentages than I am.
Given that Keith wasn't willing to throw out a percentage, I do think it's closer to the 11% than it is to the 100, though. But again, notwithstanding that, given their importance, we feel let's repropose them and get one more set of comments and then go final. Thank you.
Joe Carcello?
Wanted to talk a little bit about the fraud question, Marty. And first of all, I agree with Damon. First of all, I think an absolute liability standard would be a big mistake. Someone who's spent a lot of my professional career studying fraud, a lot of these frauds are very elaborate, and I don't know if the right answer is to embed the fraud guidance throughout all the standards or keep it separate. So I'm not going to really, I don't have a strong opinion on that. But I did want to, as some of you in the room know, that we are working, me and three other people, are working with COSO to update the study on fraud that we did in 1999. And although we're not done, we do have some preliminary information that I think is important. First of all, fraud continues to be a big problem. There's well over 300 fraud companies between 1998 and 2007. There's well over 1,000 enforcement releases related to those 300 fraud companies. In the 99 study that we did for COSO, the size of the companies was very, very small. And so someone could say, well, this is only a problem of very tiny companies. Although, by and large, fraud companies do tend to be smaller. The size of the companies has increased by over a factor of 6. That's not due to inflation, guys. You can do the math. The stock price decline is approximately 20% at the first disclosure, not necessarily a fraud, the first disclosure that there may be an accounting problem. And bankruptcy, delisting, material asset sales, and other adverse consequences to the firm and their shareholders is significantly more likely than a matched sample of no fraud companies. So this is just, you know, tidbits from my memory, and we're still doing a lot of additional work. But the reason I mention this is just for the board to understand, for the SEC representatives to understand, since this study comes from your enforcement actions, that this continues to be a major problem in the capital markets.
Good. Thanks, Joe, for that input, and Damon, thanks also for the commentary on fraud. Let's move along to the second topic, where we have issued a concept release on confirmations, and Dee Miranda Gould is going to give you a summary of the comments received there. Thanks, Dee.
Thank you, Marty. So as you're aware, we spoke with the SAG last April regarding confirmations, and we released a concept release in the middle of April. The comment period ended May 29th, and we received 24 comments. The majority of those comments, again, are from firms or associations of accountants, and then there's a smattering academics, issuers, other standard setters, other organizations, the like, in those comments. And similar to Keith's comments, I just want to go through some discussion of some key themes with those comments. Generally, commenters were supportive of the PCAOB considering revising its standard on confirmations, and that was mostly because of changes in technology that didn't exist at the time the original standard was put in place. A number of commenters, a lot of auditors, referred us to the IAASB standard, ISO 505, which deals with confirmations, and the ASB's proposed statement on auditing standards, which came out at the end of May of this year, to look to try to align with those standards and also be more principles-based in our approach, so not include a lot of additional requirements in the standard was what was recommended to us. We were also recommended to focus on risk, make the standard be based on the use of confirmations be based on an auditor's risk assessment. And then as a general comment, we received a lot of support for revising the definition of confirmation. In the concept release, we asked the question whether or not confirmation should be revised and should include direct access to information held by a third party on behalf of the confirming party. And overwhelmingly, the commenters supported us revising the definition, incorporating direct access as a confirmation. The other thing that came out of that, though, surprised us a little, was that the majority of commenters who did comment in this area also suggested that oral confirmation should not be, the oral responses should not be a confirmation. Other areas we asked questions was regarding the requirement to confirm. So we asked whether or not the standard, a revised standard, should include additional presumptions to confirm certain accounts, transactions, the like. And there were divergent views on this. Auditors generally were not supportive of expanding the presumption beyond confirming accounts receivable. And a number of other groups, the academics, some of the issuers, some of the individuals, investors, supported adding additional requirements, making the requirement to confirm cover additional areas, especially risky areas, was the general comment we got there. We also asked about disclaimers and restrictive language. That's showing up in a lot more confirmation responses. And we asked if that a new standard should include something around that, requirements for the auditor to evaluate the language that's there, specific procedures. Generally, the commenters who commented here suggested that we clarify the auditor's responsibility to consider this language and also provide perhaps some more guidance around what language creates a problem, what language doesn't create a problem. One other area we addressed was with regard to negative confirmations. We asked the question of whether or not we should keep negative confirmations as a form of confirmation and allow it in the standard. And the individuals who did respond, virtually everybody who responded on this question, suggested that we do continue to allow negative confirmations, although it was recommended that we limit when they can be used. So those are some general. There were other questions we asked in the concept release, but these were some general ones that we just wanted to highlight for you, and I'd be happy to get any input from anyone on the area of confirmations, any concerns that people think we need to consider. Paul.
And this will be very brief. It seems to me the divergent views on expanding the presumption beyond accounts receivable would be contrary to the previous slide where you say it should be risk-based. If it's risk-based, they will determine when they need to do something beyond accounts receivable. So I can't quite understand why the academics would be arguing to do more because of risk if it's already covered on the previous slide.
If I can just answer that, I think the issue there was that there are certain areas like investments and certain revenue transactions and the like that individual commenters thought were riskier areas in the first place, so that the auditor should confirm those types of things because they're higher risk and that would go along the lines of the risk focus. But I take your point. I understand the confusion there. Any other comments? Thoughts? Yeah.
It seems that all the themes I'm hearing today are auditors don't understand how to evaluate the risk of fraud. Auditors don't know how to evaluate when the risk is great enough that a third-party independent confirmation is required. Auditors don't understand, and we'll get later to how to evaluate fair value properly or related party transactions properly. And I guess I'm waiting for a conversation about how we're going to train auditors in these processes. And yet, all I'm hearing is, so let's just default to a standard that requires or presumes certain risk assessments, which goes against pretty much everything that I know about auditing, is that you're supposed to be capable of evaluating risk and employing your time and resource properly to these items. And I wish there was a place in all of this where we said we don't have to answer every failure by an auditor with a standard that requires a presumption that something is therefore high risk. We had to redo Audit Standard 2 because it was so prescriptive and it had so much if you have this, then it is a material weakness. And we backed off of that and said, for example, these are examples of what might be a material weakness, but we got rid of the always and never type of language. And so, again, I just wish there was a place in all this where students were better trained in risk assessment and audit technique and theory, and less about presumption in the standards about you have to confirm something. That ought to be left to us to decide. And if you're telling us we don't know how to decide that, then there's another failure here. But it's not necessarily always going to be resolved with or by a standard.
Can I just react to that a little bit, at least from the standpoint of risk assessment? I take your point about a large number of presumptions, certainly. I think one of the things that we tried to do with the risk assessment standards in making them in the foundational principles is to set forth a process that allows the auditor to demonstrate that they have a reasonable basis for those risk assessments, okay? And then they can develop and how they can develop responses that are commensurate with the risks. So I think that is an approach that we're trying to follow. But for purposes of standard setting and discussion, I think sometimes it's helpful to just lay out these points for discussion and say, have these risen to the point where they're important enough, often enough, that there ought to be a presumption here? It's a point of discussion. It doesn't necessarily mean that that's the intention. Okay, so.
And the last comment I'd like to make is that, of course, Dee was putting up some of the responses we got back and not necessarily how we're going to deal with those responses, but that there were some mixed views with respect to the presumptions. You were just commenting on that. So we'll take those. We're taking all of those comments into consideration, and we do think that the comments certainly supported amending the standard, but we'll take the other comments into consideration as to how we do that. And again, our target on that, according to our plan, is to get a proposed standard for public comment during the first quarter.
Sam, did you want to?
If the chairman will recognize me.
Sam Ranzilla.
Well, Marty, I thought you were just trying to cut me off, so I at least wanted to give you the chance to do that formally. Fair enough. I think Liz brings up some excellent points, and we'll get to that as we go through each of the three projects, and let me say up front, my comment has nothing to do with audit confirmations. But I agree with Liz that there is a theme running through the papers later this afternoon and tomorrow to adding requirements and very prescriptive set of standards. And I think you ought to think very long and hard about going down a path that is very prescriptive. And I also warn you about the presumptive nature that it just presumes something is a risk factor or is a bad thing, and therefore you go to, you know, an extended audit response to it. But you can avoid that by, you know, documenting in some level of detail why you overcame that presumption. Human behavior will just accept that it's whatever it is you presumed it was in the standard, because the risk of trying to get second-guessed by either me as an internal inspector or the external inspector, and quite frankly, it might be more efficient to actually just go do unnecessary work than it would be to document why you don't need to do unnecessary work. I just think going down a presumptive path is something that is in my mind, a very significant decision that the board will be making, and one that you should not take without a great deal of soul searching.
Good. Thanks for that input, Sam. Randy Fletchell?
Gosh, after that, I hate to go back to confirmation, Sam, but you mentioned there about disclaimers and restrictive language. You talked about that stuff at the last meeting in terms of seeing more of that and how to evaluate whether that was to such extent that you really couldn't treat it as audit evidence. I guess the other thing is also we've seen increasing instances where companies just won't respond. And whether that's kind of a misinterpretation of Section 303 of Sarbanes-Oxley or not, I guess I would make sure as you write your standard, not to deal with disclaimers and restrictions, but where you just recognize you're talking using confirmations more often, and yet maybe respondents are not required to send them back to you. And I don't have a solution here because you're talking about public companies, non-public individuals. It's not like there's any one group that can dictate that people have to respond. But I would encourage you in the standard itself for covering releases to recognize that as you talk about it is good evidence, try to use it more often, you know, that you're going to have to deal with situations where you are unable to get a response and have to do alternative work to satisfy the evidential matter.
Thank you, Randy. As you may be aware, in the comments we've received, we certainly received a lot of suggestions that we consider response rates and we consider disclaimers and consider whether or not there's anything we can do as a group to help improve that. So it's certainly something that we haven't forgotten and we are considering in the whole process as we go down this path. Yep. Appreciate it.
Thanks for your comments on that. So the third item we have is the concept release on potentially requiring the engagement partner to sign the audit report in addition to the firm. And that comment period is closed as well, and Bella Rivshin is going to give a summary of the comments received here.
Good afternoon. The July 28th concept release is the most recent concept release the board issued to solicit public comment on whether the board should require the auditor with final responsibility for the audit to sign the audit report in addition to the currently existing requirement for the audit firm to sign its name on the audit report. As Marty mentioned before lunch, the SAG discussed this topic last year, and this is after the U.S. Department of Treasury Advisory Committee on the Audit Profession issued their final report, which included this recommendation. The board received 23 comments from auditors, investors, academics, and others. As you can tell, most of the comment letters came from accounting firms and Association of Accountants. The comment letters can be found on the board's website under the rulemaking docket number 29, in addition to the comment letters for confirmations and also risk assessment in case after this discussion you're interested in actually looking at some more specific comments. I think differently than the comments that were received on confirmations and possibly risk assessment, there were very opposing views relating to this topic. I think it's similar to the SAG discussion. There were certain individuals on one side who felt very strongly that this is a requirement that will increase audit quality and investor protection, and there were others who felt that this would not provide any additional information as it relates to investors and would not increase the quality of the audits for several reasons. The investors who commented do think that this would enhance audit quality by strengthening the auditor accountability and improving the transparency of the audit process. There were academics who commented that stated that such a requirement could have a number of positive effects. While an association of academics commented that based on the existing research, it is unclear whether the signature of the engagement partner would improve the audit quality. Auditors felt strongly that such a requirement would not increase audit quality because partners are already held accountable to their own very strong sense of professionalism and accountability, supplemented by mechanisms that are in place to allow third parties to hold them accountable. The commenters noted that such mechanisms include the firm's own system of quality control over its auditing and accounting practice, the firm's internal inspection process, the PCAOB inspection process, and the oversight by the audit client's audit committee and other regulators such as the SEC and state boards of accountancy. Accounting firms also commented that requiring an engagement partner to sign the audit report would not provide any additional benefit over and above the existing mechanisms of accountability and transparency, and in fact could result in unintended consequences. Finally, the auditors were concerned that the signature may lead to a misconception by investors that in terms of who's actually responsible for the audit and the issuance of the audit opinion, specifically, audits are accomplished because of the resources of the firm, which include the engagement team, the engagement quality review partner, specialty partners if certain expertise is needed, and also consultation with the national office if needed. There were opposing views, again, as it relates to the transparency and also the possibility if users would be better to, by having the signature, would be better to evaluate and predict the quality of a particular audit. Investors stated that the transparency would be useful to investors, audit committees, and audit firms because it could evaluate the extent of the engagement partner's experience and the firm's policy on developing and enhancing the engagement partner's expertise, as well as oversight of engagement partners. They could evaluate the quality, expertise, and better supervision of the audit team and the entire audit process, evaluate whether the auditor biases on information processing is reduced, and whether there's enhanced auditor's consensus and effort. Academics who commented pointed out that the engagement partner is already known to the audit committee and that the knowledge and the identity of the engagement partner may be potentially helpful to investors, but they were not aware of any research that directly addresses this issue. Auditors who commented stated that the engagement partner's name is already readily known to the board of directors, management, and regulators, and they were unclear as to how the knowledge of the name would provide useful information without understanding the specific capabilities of the actual partner. Auditors stated that it's important to recognize that the corporate governance process operating under the various federal and regulatory regimes under which investors are represented by the board of directors and in turn the audit committee, and the audit committee has the responsibility to hire, evaluate, and compensate the audit firm and therefore is in the best position to evaluate the firm and the engagement partner. Auditors also commented of how they weren't clear that how the investor would be able to learn from the public disclosure of the firm partner's name, because in most cases the engagement partner would not otherwise be known to the investing public, and his and or her sole identifying characteristic would not be nothing more than that she or he is a partner at an accounting firm. They stated that it's unlikely to assist the users of audit reports to evaluate the qualifications or predict the quality of the audit because only knowing the partner's name, again, would not provide the engagement partner's expertise on a particular type of audit or his or her track record relating to that engagement and other engagements that partner is associated with. Instead, auditors stated that including the individual engagement partner signature on the audit report could create misconceptions that the single person is responsible for the effort and not the collaboration of individuals in the firm. People did mentioned that there this type of requirement could lead to some inaccuracies and conclusions about the quality of the audit under certain circumstances, because people might draw inappropriate or inaccurate conclusions about the audit based solely on the identity of the partner. People who commented on this were mainly auditors and not investors and others. The auditor stated that such a requirement could result in a creation of databases or other type of clearinghouses that would attempt to create a scorecard of the skills and qualifications of auditors, resulting in what was likely to be an incomplete and misleading information, that these types of databases could provide misleading statistical analysis based on the number of audits performed by an engagement partner, or they could level unfair criticism or create adverse publicity for an individual partner because he or she was named as an engagement partner for a controversial company or company that has gone through some financial difficulties. Auditors also stated that a scorecard would not appropriately consider the partner's expertise outside of the public company audit context, and a potential impact of these inferences may be that the engagement partner become overly concerned with such a scorecard and therefore become reluctant to be associated with certain issuers. Auditors also stated that the conclusions drawn from such inferences may result in unintended consequences for smaller firms who may not be perceived to have as a robust scorecard as compared to partners from larger firms, which may impact their ability to compete and for audits of public companies. And finally, auditors reiterated that there are many independent and dependent variables that affect any simple statistic of audit quality, only one of which is the identity of the engagement partner. The auditors did also note some other unintended consequences. As I say unintended consequences, I keep looking over to see if Lynn is over there to comment on the word. The auditors reiterated that the requirement runs counter to how the carefully cultivated culture of collaboration in the firms, that was a mouthful, and would send the wrong message to the marketplace that the opinion is the engagement partner's sole responsibility. There also, as I mentioned, could be what is called guilt by association of certain audits. If there's a partner who's repeatedly tasked with handling the most toughest of the audit engagements, the public may gain an inaccurate impression of that partner due to the perception of guilt by association with companies with financial reporting difficulties. And as a result, there could be the willingness of audit partners to serve on engagements for certain audit clients may wane. Auditors also were concerned that investors could second-guess an audit committee selection of an audit firm and the engagement partner, that the shareholders may believe that it is appropriate to contact the engagement partner directly to ask questions about the audit and the company's financial statements and other matters. This would put both the shareholders and the auditors in an uncomfortable position because a lot of the questions probably the auditor could not answer due to confidentiality requirements. Auditors mentioned that there could be harassment and personal danger to an individual audit partner, and that the heightened concerns about personal risk may cause an engagement partner to be less willing, again, to make the professional judgments imperative to the execution and timeliness and cost-effectiveness of high-quality audits. And finally, auditors stated this could increase the individual liability of partners, which could result in a number of partners willing to sign audit company opinions to be lower and a number of firms willing to undertake this type of work to be negatively impacted. Those firms in the marketplace, they stated, remaining could potentially charge higher fees to the perceived increased liability. As I stated, these were very interesting comment letters to read and very opposing views on this matter, and you're more than welcome to read them in more depth and, on our rulemaking docket on our website. I'll now open up for comments to SAG members and observers. And Wayne Collins.
Yeah, mine is more of a process question. I note that of the 23 comment letters, 17 were from accounting firms or associations of accountants. So, you know, six were from non-accounting related sources. In the board's deliberation of a standard, obviously you're looking at the substantive nature of the comments that are made, but to what extent is there the way that the quantitative nature of the comments espousing a certain position?